From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I am from Livermore.
I'm from East Oakland.
Oakland, near Lake Merritt.
Alameda, California.
I'm in the Excelsior neighborhood.
Cambridge, Massachusetts, but I grew up in Sonoma County.
Coming up, why BART cars are wider than most other trains and why that's a problem.
When you go back 40, 50 years, it's hard to read the minds of the people who are building something from the ground up.
Then a Southern California Water District wants to buy land in the Delta, and the locals don't trust it.
They just have a reputation of getting water, of trying to get water that maybe people think they don't deserve.
And we'll hear what it sounds like when you combine Oakland's politics with classic soul and hip hop.
It's speaking to you in a way that is more than just words alone.
The infrastructure and the music that connects the Bay, today on Cross Currents. In 2018, Bay Area commuters will be able to get a little farther on BART. The agency is building a 10-mile extension to the Pittsburgh Bay Point line to go all the way to Antioch. It'll be called eBART for East Contra Costa County. But to get on the extension, riders will have to transfer at the last BART stop. That's Pittsburgh Bay Point. They'll get out onto the platform and get on a whole new different train. Why? Well, because the new extension's tracks are regular-sized tracks, and the rest of BART's tracks are wider than normal. BART's unusually wide tracks and cars have always made the system tricky to work with. They're incompatible with other systems like Caltrain and Amtrak, and KALW listener David Wright thinks that's a bad thing.
When rail systems are built, they're standardization is part of the whole scheme of why things work.
So he reached out to our crowdsourced collaborative reporting project, Hey Area, and he asked,
why are BART tracks a different gauge from all other train tracks?
We sent KALW's Angela Johnston to find out.
So the first place I go to look for answers is BART itself, to the Richmond Repair Garage. There I meet Jim Allison. He's the media spokesperson for BART.
You can see that we have some of the cars are on lifts. They're being worked on. Some of the cars are...
This is the place where BART trains come for their usual checkups. Air conditioning systems are getting fixed. Train connectors are getting tightened. Allison takes me outside and we stand next to some BART tracks.
You can see right here the gauge of the track and how wide it is. And if we could magically hover above, we could go over there to the Amtrak tracks and you would see the difference in terms of the width. These are much wider.
BART tracks are 5 feet and 6 inches wide. Standard tracks like Caltrain and Muni, Amtrak, and almost every other train in the world are just 4 feet, 8.5 inches wide, close to a foot narrower. Why? Allison says to understand that, we have to understand what the vision was.
The concept behind BART was to provide an entirely new form of transportation for the Bay Area.
One that would be luxurious enough to get people out of their cars.
It was supposed to be like airline travel back when airline travel was glamorous.
BART actually uses aerospace technology, and the cars are made out of aluminum rather than steel, which makes them around 80,000 tons lighter than most other U.S. train cars. Allison says that's one possible reason why BART uses a wider gauge.
It was built to be a more stable ride, to be a smoother ride.
Especially if the plan was to have BART go across the Golden Gate Bridge in high winds on a second deck. And yes, that was a real plan. It didn't happen, but Allison says the engineers thought they still needed all the stability a wider gauge could give them. Allison says there's a second reason for the wide gauge. BART wanted a closed system that they completely controlled.
If the Union Pacific owns the tracks and they have an important freight train that needs to go through, they might delay an Amtrak train and people just have to deal with that, sit there and wait. BART, they didn't want that.
So who do we thank or blame for this? Allison doesn't know, but he tells me who might.
I'm Mike Healy, and I was the chief spokesperson and head of media and public affairs for BART for about 32 years.
Healy was there when the very first BART train made its way around the bay on September 11th, 1972.
We had journalists from all over the world coming to view this brand new transit system, which was the first transit system to be built in the U.S. in almost 60 years.
So do you know who made the decision?
You know, it's a good question, and I'm not sure anybody today would know the answer because most of the people that were involved have passed on since those days.
But he does show me the original 1962 BART composite report, a document presented to the BART Board of Supervisors before Bay Area residents voted on the original BART bond. On it are the names Walter S. Douglas, Ralph A. Tudor, and John Keeley. They were the chief engineers for Parsons, Brinkerhoff, Tudor, and Bechtel, the joint venture of engineering firms who drew up a vision for how BART would work.
I don't think anybody at BART ever, or the original designers ever regretted using the wider gauge.
Unfortunately, I can't ask them if they agree. My research stopped at their obituaries. But their early decision to approve a wide gauge has some other people frustrated.
I think the number one problem is about interoperability, that we can't move trains from one kind of track onto the BART track, so they might go better utilized if you could have more systems running on the same set of tracks.
Ratna Amin is the transportation policy director at SPUR. She says that decision Jim Allison mentioned to keep BART tracks totally independent and wide has had lasting consequences.
Today, you have BART across the bay and no standard rail and no freight rail. And it didn't have to be that way. They could have been something that is shared.
If we could run other trains on BART tracks or vice versa, you could go to, say, the MacArthur station and catch a few different types of rail, not just BART.
There would be more of an emphasis on stations and service, fast service, slow service, from here to there, rather than it's a BART train, it's a Caltrain, it's a high-speed rail train.
Another big problem BART's wide gauge causes, it's really expensive to fix because every part has to be custom made.
What happens with technology is if you don't have a big market, then there's no innovation, there's no economies of scale. The market becomes very, very small.
Like Healy, Amin didn't know who was in the room when the decision to use wide gauge was made. But she did put me in touch with one last person she thought could help, the Honorable Rod Diridon, the executive director of San Jose State's Mineta Transportation Institute. All right, what are you showing me right now?
I'm showing you the 1955 original study done for the BART system.
Diridon's office is a transportation artifact gold mine. There are model high-speed rail trains in glass cases, a giant brass train bell on the door, and posters of when San Jose named their train station, Diridon Station, after him. And an even earlier BART document.
All right, why don't you start flipping pages?
Okay. The plan is huge. It takes up a quarter of the table. We have to use both our hands to flip through the pages, looking for mentions of wide gauge and the names associated with that decision. We flip through maps of where BART was projected to go. And remember how BART was supposed to cross the Golden Gate Bridge? Well, we find a map that shows a picture of four bay crossings. Four. Finally, we come to a section that looks promising.
Design elements basic to both systems. Maybe we look there. That's page 79. Each of the two trucks supporting a car has four rolled steel wheels, 31 inches in diameter, mounted at standard gauge of 4 feet and 8.5 inches, and a wheelbase of 7 feet, 6 inches. So that's standard gauge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Four. Okay.
Well, so the first study recommended standard gauge.
It all could have been different.
And in the future, it could be different. Diridon says it's time for another big push for new transit in the Bay Area. And one solution could be laying down a new track to fit standard gauge trains.
Well, that's a multi tens of billions of dollars worth of cost. But it needs to be done sooner than later.
He says, in hindsight, it looks like BART focused so much on being the transit system of the future that it got itself stuck in the past.
So now we have one of a kind. You might say it's a dinosaur.
Dinosaur or not, BART's Jim Allison is focused on keeping the trains he has up and running.
Yeah, it'd be wonderful to take the knowledge that we have today and apply it back in time, but that's not the reality.
If he could go back in time?
If I were in the planning room when BART was being drawn up on the blueprints and I had my white short sleeve shirt on and smoking a Camel cigarette, I would probably want to have a nice stereo system so that our trains could blast some Muzak and calm people down.
For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
That story came from a listener suggestion to our Hey Area project, where you ask the questions and we find the answers. So if you've got a question you want one of our reporters to investigate, head to KALW.org and look for the box that says Hey Area. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Well, it'll be 2 years before you can get on that BART train to Antioch. That will take you east, close to Bethel Island on the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. It's the state's biggest water supply, providing water for 25 million people. It's also the most contested. Northern and Southern Californians have been fighting over who's entitled to that water for more than a century. The latest battle is actually playing out right now. The largest water supplier in the country, Metropolitan Water District, is trying to buy 20,000 acres of land in the Delta. Reporter Nick Stockton covered the issue for Wired magazine. He says the sale could be a big power play in California's complicated water politics. It could be the start of the groundwork in Governor Brown's proposed Twin Tunnels project. Nick Stockton sat down with KALW's Audrey Dilling to explain.
Could you explain what that Twin Tunnels project is?
So probably best to go back, take a step back and just kind of understand what the Delta is. The Delta is this gigantic, I mean, it's a delta. It looks like a delta, like anything you'd see in, you know, the River Nile or whatever, except it's inland. It's like there's the San Francisco Bay, and then there's a range of mountains between that and this gigantic valley in the middle of California. And these two kind of big watersheds run into this delta. And there's about 70 islands in there, and most of them are farmland. And a lot of the state's water comes through there. So getting that water from Northern California to Southern California, there's these two big pumping stations at the southernmost end of the Delta, and one of them is owned by the state and one of them is owned by the feds. And every time they turn those on, they pump water from the east down to like farmers or whatever, or to the Metropolitan Water District. But doing so causes the water in the Delta to run backwards from the sea inlet and causes that water to get really salty. And there's several endangered species of fish in there, and there's also just habitat issues, and also that makes the water just in general more salty, which hurts the water quality for the farmers and stuff who actually live in the Delta. So in order to make it so turning on those pumps does not affect the water quality in the Delta, Governor Brown has proposed building these two gigantic tunnels about 40 miles long each. They're twin tunnels, and what they would do is tap the Sacramento River a little further upstream before it gets to the Delta. So instead of making the Delta waters run backwards, it would just pull water straight from there.
So this is a land purchase, but can you explain why people are calling it a water grab?
The reason they call it a water grab is because, I mean, it's not a direct, it's not like they're buying these islands and they get a bunch of water. They do get some water, but it, as far as like how much water they already have rights to and how much water they need more of, it's literally a drop in the bucket. What it really does is it gives them more negotiating power to try and get these two tunnels built, which they really want built, because it would mean that they are no longer subject to as many environmental restrictions as they are now when what happens when water is low and they try and turn these gigantic pumps on and get water shipped from Northern California to Southern California.
I'm speaking with Wired reporter Nick Stockton about a Southern California water district's attempt to purchase land in the Sacramento Delta. So it sounds like there's a lot of mistrust out there for Metropolitan Water District. Is there any precedence that we can look to for why people are so distrustful of this district?
Yes. It goes back a long ways. I mean, first and foremost, the Metropolitan Water District was the first and still the largest customer of the State Water Project, which is like one of the big pumping stations in the Delta. They get a lot of the blame for, you know, the water problems that come up in the Delta and the fact that we have endangered species there now and the water's getting saline and stuff like that. So that falls on them, you know, whether deserved or not. They also, you know, they built the Colorado Aqueduct, and they end up using their money to buy a lot of water rights from farmers over on the Arizona border, which people are kind of like, you know, they just have a reputation of getting water, of trying to get water that maybe people think they don't deserve. And the biggest example of that goes back to the Owens River Valley controversy, which is like the origin of the California Water Wars, of, you know, that thing. And that was back in the early 1900s. LA's mayor and some other people in the city's leadership decided that LA wanted to be bigger and it just didn't have enough water. So they were eyeballing this valley called the Owens Valley and the water there. And they did some shady real estate deals. The mayor actually bought land under his own name with plans to sell it back to the city at a nice little profit. And they ended up doing all this stuff, getting all this land, getting the rights to this watershed, and built the LA Aqueduct through there. And I mean, that was huge. That was the inspiration for the movie Chinatown. Like, that is like I call it the Godwin's Law of California water politics. It's like, anytime you want to call somebody out for being a water thief, you bring up Owens River Valley, and that's like, you know, that's what it is.
Metropolitan is saying that they are interested in the land because it gives them access to making environmental improvements to the Delta ecosystem. Do you believe that?
It's possible. No matter what happens with this purchase or whatever, the environmental protections over the Delta are going to stay there, and they need to. Like, if you're because of the decisions that were made in the Delta, these pumps are at the bottom, are at the southernmost end, and if they get turned on, it makes the Delta very saline, and that affects water quality for anybody who wants to use it. And the more saline it gets, the worse the environment gets. And environment is like, you know, people can go back and forth about environmental protection or whatever, but, you know, there's no argument that if you have a better environment around your watershed, your water's going to be better. It's the best investment you can make in clean water is to have just, you know, a good ecosystem surrounding it. It's better than any chemicals or whatever you can dump in the water to clean it up. So there is some truth to that, but there's also, it could be somewhat duplicitous, because if they do succeed in building these tunnels, then they tap their water north of the Delta, and they're no longer kind of subject to what happens inside the Delta, to some degree. And there are some other factors that could go in. They could still be restrained, because even if you're tapping water upstream of the Delta, you're not necessarily making the Delta flow backwards, but you are reducing the amount of the volume of water that goes into the Delta, which is problematic, because, you know, water has to flow out into the sea, or else the sea starts flowing in. The Central Valley, where this Delta is very low. It's basically sea level, and it's basically just the pressure of these rivers flowing out that keeps from turning into an inland sea.
That was Wired reporter Nick Stockton. He spoke with KALW's Audrey Dilling. You can find a link to his article about Metropolitan Water District's Delta Island purchase at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we're going to switch gears and introduce you to the musicians of Antique Naked Soul. Their music comes out of Oakland, and they'll tell us how that inspires their sound in this edition of Bay Area Beats.
Ooh la la la, Antique's on the mic and she's doing her thing. Ooh la la la, it's the natural vibe that the naked soul bring. Ooh la 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 la, we swing.
You know you never heard this before.
So I am Antique, and we are Antique Naked Soul. We are an all vocal, I guess, beatboxing soul band.
So my name is Nagala McCoy, and I am on background vocals. I support.
My name is Jamie Brown. I am also on background vocals, and I'm also the music director.
Tommy Solati Shepherd. I do some of the bass lines and all the percussion.
So all the sounds that you hear are sounds that we're making with our voices only, and we do live looping on stage when we're building beats on stage during our performances.
Looping is a thing where you can record your voice. You can determine how long you want your voice to be recorded, and when you stop that, your voice starts over again with what you recorded, and it comes back around again and again and again. Now, every time it comes back around, you're able to record something else on top of that. That way you can build up full chords of music, or you can build up full drum sets of things, or full soundscapes of environments and things like that.
We can also do vocal sort of impressions of instruments. We kind of simulate the sound of a band with just our voices alone.
See, support. Support.
It's kind of an illusion. We're not really trying to sound like these instruments. We're just placing notes where these instruments would be playing.
Right.
And you get it, and you wind up being fooled too.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually.
I think somebody had asked Jamie, do you have the number to your drummer?
Yes.
Can I get it? We were like, that's not drums, actually.
Yep. Just Tommy.
Everywhere I've been in the world, hip hop has been like a catalyst, you know. It's been empowering to people in Cuba and Honduras and in Africa and all over the world. So there's something about it that's really special.
Come a force, better move out, fall back, take cover anywhere. You can't evade all that syntax, fire that, stop and frisk motions. The chemical catapulting explosions. My hoodies, I'm a hoofer, real finna boy, trying to build and rebuild. What you saying to the soil now? Who's with me? Who I'm up against? Who fucking up to Remy Khan on the lines of defense?
We won't march, we won't chant, we won't stand for your benign neglect.
We ain't taking it, we ain't taking no more, we ain't taking that.
We won't turn the other cheek, cause what we seek is equality. Nah.
So that song was called Burn, it was written as a part of actually a theater piece that was inspired by Jeff Chang's book Can't Stop, Won't Stop. Based on what was going on nationally in the news, what was going on in Ferguson, what was going on in Baltimore, and really all over the country, Florida, Oakland, everywhere, knowing that there's been, you know, almost 400 police murders this year, and that we felt like we had to respond to that and say something about that.
No more water for the fires.
It's a lot of things, actually,
yeah.
to be honest, and I know we all feel it. We feel like connected, but we also feel like we're preaching to a choir, like a very loud choir, but you know, it's still, we're preaching to the choir.
See, the pretense is we don't want a home. In fact, we neglect the brimming jewelries on the thousand and the ride of the tech. If we don't see it in our eyes, I see it in our protest. If they don't hear it, then the worst one understand the process of progress. We need water. Babylon is burning. It's broken glass, smoke and pee. Everywhere we're turning, we're grinding, no regret, no regret, no we're learning. No, our machine knowledge, watch your back, we emerging.
Poverty. You don't care, forget humanity.
People get it. They get the song. They know exactly why it's being sang. They understand the words and they believe it themselves.
Any consequence, no. Yeah. 'Cause I keep democracy. It's a
think something that music in general can do is, I mean, we could just be at a podium just shouting the messages that we have. We could just be, you know, just be preachers saying all of the messages that we have in our music. But I think it's important for people to be able to groove to what is being said as well, because it gets ingrained in you subconsciously, because you're feeling it in your body, you're feeling it not just what's being said, but movement to it as well. And then emotionally, you're able to latch onto what's being said, because it's speaking to you in a way that is more than just words alone.
Clouds are pitch black, smoke beginning to strangle. Oh, say, huh, can't you see the stars, mango? Global warming's about to take its turn on the planet, and damn it, ain't nobody even concerned. We seem too intent.
That piece was produced by KALW's Julie Kane. Antique Naked Soul is on a world tour right now. Find details about when they'll be back in the States at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. And we're always on the lookout for cool music around the Bay. So who should we be featuring next? You tell us. Email us at news@kalw.org or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. We'd love to hear from you because we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Lila Day, Nicole Grigg, Angela Johnston, Jurgen Klem, Abhilasha Madan, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Mary Lee Williams. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producers were Jeremy Dalmas and Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.